Hi, is this Tom? We're waiting for people to log on to the call. It'll be just a minute. We're in presentation mode today, so we can't hear you. So we're going to wait just a minute and let people log on. There's quite a few people calling in. We're also waiting for another one of our presenters to get on the line, so just hang on. Hi, we're just pausing just a minute. There's quite a few people logging into the call. We're going to give them an opportunity to get situated. We're in presentation mode today. We'll have a very nice clear connection, and we'll remind you at the end of the call for those of you that have questions, simply just to unmute your phone by pressing star 6. Mr. Joy, are you on the line?
Yes, I am, Leslie.
Terrific. We'll just pause for another moment, and then we'll get started. Hello.
Hi.
Yes, good morning. We're waiting for people to log in. We've got quite a group coming into the call, and we'll get started in just a moment.
Okay.
We're in presentation mode today, so we should have a very nice clear connection. If for some reason you hear any background noise, you can always do star 6, but I think it's going to be nice and clear for everybody. We have a lot of international callers coming onto the line as well. So I think we'll pause just for another brief moment, and then we'll get started. Thank you for your patience. Hi, we're just pausing for people to log on to the call. We'll start in just a moment. All right, I think we're ready to get started. Welcome and thank you for joining the Immigration Solutions teleconference today. We've been asked by popular demand to come back. This is our first conference this year, and it's an important one. We'll be talking today. Our topic is tougher standards for H-1Bs. My name is Leslie Davis. I'm the managing director of the firm, and we're glad that you've given us your valuable time today. For immigration practitioners and employees and employers in H-1B status and those that bring skilled workers in, to work here in the United States. It's been a rather interesting and confusing couple of weeks. And for these reasons, we were prompted to want to have this conference today to reach out to our clients as well as our readership. And it is a free conference that we're providing today. Basically, the trickle-down effect in the last few weeks has been a USCIS memo that was put out that they felt that they needed to excessively over-define the role of the employer and the employee. Although these roles have previously been defined, they have really rather extended the definition of the relationship, which is strongly affecting the landscape of the way a lot of employers bring talent into the United States. And we're going to be focusing in on a couple of industries today that may be more affected than others. We also heard of several incidents of Canadians applying for H-1Bs at the border and being overly questioned by Customs and Border Protection officers, referred to as CBP officers, where they, you know, I call it absolutely went off the reservation a little bit and started expressing a lot of opinion that was very confusing to the applicants. Lastly, just last week, we heard of an incident at the Newark Airport in Newark, New Jersey, where CBP, Customs and Border Protection, were aligning with ICE and investigating some H-1B employers and their employees that happened to have been permitted to get on an airplane and were actually taken off the airplane and questioned and detained. And so these incidents have jarred immigration attorneys and employers that sponsor H-1Bs, and we're going to be addressing these issues today, and we'll pretty much follow our agenda. We will be unpacking this whole topic of tougher standards in filing H-1Bs, considering that the season is upon us, and we're able to do to file H-1Bs as of April 1st for new applicants. So we're going to discuss the tougher standards, the new documentation requirements, and we will move into the memo and discuss what immigration is setting forth for the employer-employee relationship. We'll also talk about and kind of conclude the call with some of our comments about comprehensive immigration reform. Is it going to pass? Isn't it? Will we see piecemeal, perhaps, legislation that might affect employment-based immigration? So we will close with that, and then we'll open up the last 15 minutes for Q&A. Before we get started, I wanted to introduce to you our speaker, Attorney Thomas Joy. Tom is the supervising attorney of our business unit here at Immigration Solutions. He specializes in the practice of immigration and nationality law and is a veteran of some 25 years in the field. And pretty much his focus is on employment-related immigration. Over the years and presently, he's represented multinational companies, major IT companies, healthcare systems, and associated businesses to IT and healthcare, and organizations in the arts and sciences. We feel that he's also an expert when it comes to employer compliance, which has become a very active practice area today with all of the H-1B on-site inspections and I-9 audits taking place. This is another area of practice here at Immigration Solutions. So without further ado, I'd like to introduce Tom Joy and turn the call over to him. And we'll go, Tom, probably for a good 35 to 40 minutes at present. So it's all yours.
Thank you, Leslie. Good morning and good afternoon, wherever you are. Some basics as we start out. It's H-1B filing season again. The quota for employees to start on H-1Bs will start this coming October 1, 2010. The filing period starts 6 months earlier, April 1, 2010. As you probably all know, there are 65,000 regular H-1Bs per year and 20,000 additional H-1Bs for graduates with advanced degrees from U.S. Universities, master's or higher degrees. In the past 2 years, immigration has intaked all applications filed between April 1 or received between April 1 and April 7. If it is more than the quota, they hold a random lottery to see who gets the 65,000 and the 20,000. If it's less than the quota limits, they continue intaking until they hit the quota limits, and no lottery is held. In 2007, they received, when it was April 1st only, not the first week of April, they received 150,000 petitions on April 1st in the mail. They held a random lottery. In 2008, they expanded the intake to the first week of April, April 1 to April 7. They received 150,000 approximately the first week of April, and they held a random lottery. In 2009, a year ago, something interesting happened. They only received 42,000 applications during the first week of April, and no lottery was held. They continued to intake and intake and intake until they finally ran out on December 21st. Why did H-1Bs last so long? Most people will say it's the economy. However, in view of our conference call today, we think there was more to it than just the economy. There was an increased scrutiny by the Immigration Service, by USCIS, and increased denials. And that's why the number was held down for so long. There are also problems with the new Department of Labor electronic LCA system. There are delays in that system, bureaucratic red tape to be dealt with. And as a result, for all those reasons, the demand, the limited quota, the LCA problems with Department of Labor, our advice, as always, is to start early to prepare. It is not too early now, February 10, to start preparing, identifying your H-1B employees if you have not already, gathering documents, and preparing for the LCA and filing the LCA in anticipation of having your paperwork ready on March 31st to send by overnight, FedEx, whatever, to the USCIS for receipt on April 1st. As usual, there are certain groups exempt from the quota. The four basic groups are universities as employers, nonprofit organizations with certain affiliation arrangements with universities, nonprofit research organizations, and government research organizations. In addition, if your employee already has an H-1B and he or she is merely extending it, there is no quota requirement. They're exempt. And if you are hiring an employee from another H-1B employer, in other words, if your new employee is transferring from a previous H-1B employer, he or she is also exempt from the quota. So I mentioned increased scrutiny. The biggest attention getter, Leslie mentioned in the introduction, was what's happened recently at Newark International Airport in New Jersey. Certain H-1Bs are being identified as they return to the United States, say from a vacation abroad or a business trip abroad, being identified for further scrutiny. These are H-1Bs. Generally for consulting companies and staffing companies or job shops. They are put into secondary inspection. Secondary inspection is the back office at the airport where more seasoned and experienced immigration officers will question the employee about his intent in coming to the United States and what does he do, who will he work for, what are the details of that employment arrangement. We are advising people, whether they're coming through Newark or any other international airport or walking across the border or driving across the border or coming on a boat, be prepared. Carry your documentation. Have a current employment letter from the H-1B employer verifying that the employment is ongoing. Carry the last few paycheck stubs. And most important, carry a copy of the underlying petition with the supporting letter written by the employer. And most importantly on that issue, tell your employees to please be familiar with everything in that supporting letter. If there are any questions about what your employee will be doing in the United States, it's all in the letter. Be familiar with it. That's where the questions will come from, and that's where they'll be tripped up if they don't know what's in the letter and what they're going to do. In addition, for the last 2 to 3 years, maybe, we've been receiving an increased number of RFEs. RFE stands for Request for Evidence. Request for Additional Evidence on Pending Cases at the USCIS Service Center. They're raising several issues, including requesting more detailed job descriptions, the need of the employers, they're questioning the employer's need for an H-1B professional. Why would a small startup company need a full-time staff accountant, for example, or a marketing analyst? They question, as they always have, the qualifications of the alien beneficiary, the prospective employee. And more recently in the IT industry, the healthcare industry specifically, they're questioning the employer-employee relationship. If you're in the IT industry, you're familiar with arrangements that staffing companies have where there's two, three, four layers of vendors between your staffing company and the end client, and there's two, three, four contracts that provide whatever in between your company and the end user. Well, those RFEs, those requests for evidence, have been growing and growing and growing in the past couple of years, and each time we see one, there's additional requests added to it. As a result, on January 8th of this year, last month, USCIS headquarters issued a memorandum. It was signed by Donald Neufeld, who's the Associate Director of Service Center Operations, and it's entitled Determining Employer-Employee Relationship for Adjudication of H-1B Petitions, Including Third-Party Site Placements. And I'll repeat that last part. Including Third-Party Site Placements. That seems to be the target of this memorandum, among other things, as you'll see in a moment. But they are focusing on staffing companies, job shops, as they're called, and consulting companies. If you are in the IT industry or the healthcare industry specifically, you know exactly what I'm talking about. And pay special attention to this, because you may not be able to get any more H-1Bs unless you adjust your contracts, you get your clients, your end-user clients, to cooperate with you, and adjust the documentation and the underlying arrangement. It's a new day in the industry. What worked last year and the year before and the many years before that will not work anymore, according to this memorandum. Now, granted, this memorandum just came out. It is quite controversial. I'm convinced, as an attorney, that it will be challenged in court and litigated, and my brief review of it tells me that I think we can win and overturn this memorandum, because it goes against many years of precedent and procedure that everybody has been operating under, and it goes against common law and definitions and Supreme Court definitions of employer-employee relationships. But that being said, we have to deal with it for now, and that will be the focus of what we're going to talk about now. In turning to the memorandum itself, it starts out by quoting the USCIS regulations. Only a United States employer can file an H-1B petition. A United States employer is defined in the regulations as a company, organization, whatever, that engages a person to work within the United States. Number two, has an employer-employee relationship with respect to employees as indicated by the fact that it may hire, pay, fire, supervise, or otherwise control the work of any such employee. And third, has an IRS tax identification number. Well, number one and number three are easy. Engages a person to work within the U.S. and has an IRS tax identification number. Number two, we're going to focus on number two, has an employer-employee relationship with respect to employees, as indicated by the fact that it may hire, pay, fire, supervise, or otherwise control, and the word control is key here, or otherwise control the work of any such employee. Because there's been an almost total lack of guidance on what's a valid employer-employee relationship, there have been many issues raised, in particular regarding independent contractors, self-employed beneficiaries, and most importantly to our conversation, beneficiaries placed at third-party work sites. We're going to talk briefly about independent contractors and self-employed persons, but the focus will be on employees placed at third-party work sites. The placement of an alien employee at a work site that is not operated by the petitioning employer, what we call third-party placements, which is common in some industries, namely healthcare and IT, generally makes it more difficult to assess whether the requisite employer-employee relationship exists and will continue to exist. The key point is petitioning employer control over the beneficiary, over the alien beneficiary employee, must be established when the employee is placed at another employer's business and expected to become a part of the business's regular operations. The control may not exist in certain instances when the petitioner's business is to provide employees to fill vacancies at businesses that contract with the petitioner for personnel needs, at staffing companies or consulting companies, as they oftentimes call themselves. So what is an employer-employee relationship? Now, that's the million-dollar question. USCIS has interpreted an employer-employee relationship as the conventional master-servant relationship as understood by common law agency doctrine. Well, that's legalese. The Supreme Court, in a case from 1992, focused on control. It basically said, we consider the hiring parties right to control the manner and means by which the product is accomplished. So the USCIS, the immigration, will look at a number of factors to see if there's control. But the most important part I want to emphasize today is it's more than merely paying the salary or placing the person on your payroll. Sure, staffing companies put people on the payroll or pay their salary, but it's more than that. The USCIS must determine if the employer has a sufficient level of control over the employee. The petitioning employer must be able to establish that it has the right to control over when, where, and how the alien beneficiary performs the job, the H-1B employee, when, where, and how they perform the job. And they consider all of the following factors. Now, there are a number of factors here that I'm going to read. No one by itself is decisive, but they look at the entire picture as a whole. And after looking at the factors, they add it up, and it's somewhat subjective, but objectively we can look at factors. Number one, does the petitioning employer supervise the employee, and is such supervision off-site or on-site? As we go through these, think of what your companies do and see which one of these are going to be an issue for you under the new criteria. Number two, if the supervision is off-site, how does the petitioning employer maintain such supervision? For example, weekly calls, reporting back to the main office routinely, or site visits by the employer. Number three, does the petitioner have the right to control the work of the employee on a day-to-day basis if such control is required? Again, you see the common theme here, right to control. Number four, does the petitioning employer provide the tools or instrumentalities needed for the beneficiary to perform the duties of employment? Number five, does the petitioner hire, pay, have the ability to fire the beneficiary? Those words sound familiar. They're right from the regulation, but they're blended in with all these other factors. Number six, does the petitioning employer evaluate the work product of the beneficiary? For example, progress or performance reviews. Number seven, does the petitioner claim the beneficiary for tax purposes? Number eight, does the petitioner provide the beneficiary any type of employee benefits? Number nine, does the employee use proprietary information of the petitioning employer in order to perform the duties of employment? Number 10, does the beneficiary produce an end product that is directly linked to the petitioning employer's line of business? And number 11, does the petitioner have the ability to control the manner and means in which the work product of the beneficiary is accomplished. Now, for convenience, the USCIS in this memorandum has given us some examples. In one they call traditional employment, that's where the alien beneficiary, the employee, works at an office located or office location that is owned or leased by the petitioner. He reports directly to the petitioner on a daily basis. The petitioner sets the work schedule of the employee. The employee uses the petitioner's tools to perform the duties, and the petitioning employer directly reviews the work product. And the petitioning employee claims the alien for tax purposes and medical benefits and all that. That's an easy one. That's a clear employer-employee relationship, a plain vanilla case, we call it. A little more complicated, temporary occasional off-site employment. The example they give is the petitioning employer is an accounting firm with a number of clients. The alien beneficiary is an accountant. The employee is required to travel to different client sites for auditing purposes. The employee uses established employer practices. If he travels off-site, the employer provides food and lodging costs to the employer. The employee reports to a central office, and when not performing audits for clients off-site, has an assigned office space, and he's paid and receives benefits. Again, an easy case. Long-term permanent off-site placement. The example given is the employer is an architectural firm, and the employee is an architect. There's a contract between the architecture firm and an end-user client to build a structure in a location that's out of state, outside of where the employer's main office is. The architectural firm has to place the architects at the off-site location while the building is being built. The contract between the employer and the client and its client states that the employer will manage its employees at the off-site location. The underlying contract states that the employer has the right to ultimate control of its own employees' work. Again, that will work. And then finally, and more relevant to our discussion, if you're in the IT industry, the example they give for long-term placement at a third-party work site is the petitioning employer is a computer software development company which has contracted with another unrelated company to develop an in-house computer program to track merchandise using the employer's proprietary software and expertise. In order to complete the project, the employer has contracted to place its software engineers at the client's main warehouse where they will develop a computer system. The alien beneficiary, the employee, is a software engineer who has been offered employment to fulfill the needs of the contract in place between the employer and the client. The employee performs his duties at the client company's facility, but the key point is while he's at the client's facility, the employee reports weekly to a manager who is employed by the petitioning company, by his employer, not the end user client. And again, the employee is paid by the employer and not by the end user. Those are all satisfactory arrangements that are listed in this memorandum. So if you come within those guidelines, you're okay. They then give some examples of arrangements that will not work. They mention self-employed beneficiaries. This one I in particular disagree with. They blur the line between a corporation and its majority or sole shareholder. They say that there is no distinction. The law says there is. The corporation is a separate legal person from its owners. So that one I think will be litigated. Independent contractors. If someone is clearly an independent contractor and not controlled as to how, when, where, and whatever they do the business, That's not an employer-employee relationship. The one I want to focus on that the government says will not work is what they entitle third-party placement or job shop cases. And the example is critical here. It involves a computer consulting company, but if you're a healthcare company, wherever it says computer, substitute healthcare, and you'll see the example more clearly. The petitioner is a computer consulting company. The petitioning employer contracts with numerous outside companies in which it supplies these companies with employees to fulfill specific staffing needs. The specific positions are not outlined in the contract between the petitioning employer and the third-party company, but are staffed on an as-needed basis. The alien employee in this case is a computer analyst. He has been assigned to work for the third-party company to fill a core position to maintain the third-party company's payroll. Once placed at the client company, the alien beneficiary reports to a manager who works for the third-party company. Key point. His manager works for the third-party client, not for his own employer, the staffing company. The employee does not report to the petitioning employer, the staffing company, for work assignments, and all work assignments are determined by the third-party company, by the client. The petitioning employer does not control how the employee will complete daily tasks, and no proprietary information of the petitioning employer, the staffing company, the consulting company, is used by the beneficiary to complete any work assignments. The employee's end product, the payroll, is not in any way related to the petitioning employer's line of business, which is computer consulting. The employee's progress reviews are completed by the client company, not the petitioner. Again, that will not work because there's the petitioning consulting company or staffing company in other cases has no right to control, and there's no exercise of control in that case. That's a clear case of why it will not work under the new criteria. Most cases will fall somewhere in between in a gray area. The memorandum is somewhat helpful in telling us what we should present in the way of documentation for proving the ability to hire, fire, supervise, and be responsible for the overall direction of the employee's work. So they say providing a combination of the following or similar types of evidence. And there's a number of these, and I'm going to go through them. And as I list them, it might be useful to you to think, do we use these or do we not use these? And if we don't use these, can we start to use these, or can we adjust our arrangement with our end user client to use this documentation? Otherwise, I don't see you getting an H-1B anytime soon under this new memorandum. The first thing they mention, a complete itinerary of services or engagements that specifies the dates of each service, the names and addresses of the actual employers, and the address of the establishment, the venues, the locations where the services will be performed in the periods of time. An itinerary. If your employee is going to be placed at numerous job sites or client sites around the country, you need an itinerary. In the past, they were somewhat flexible on that. You could indicate various non-anticipated locations throughout the United States. That may not be true anymore. Copy of signed employment agreements between the petitioning employer and the alien employee detailing the terms of employment. A copy of the offer of employment that clearly describes the nature of the employer-employee relationship and the services. A copy of relevant portions of contracts between the petitioning employer and the end-user client. Copies of signed contractual agreements, statements of work orders, service agreements, and letters between the petitioner and authorized officials of the ultimate end-client companies. Copies of job descriptions, that describe the tools and the work to be performed at the location. Performance reviews and the petitioning employer's organizational chart. These are key documentation. No one document is decisive. You should have as many as possible. But again, each case is decided on a case-by-case basis after reviewing the evidence. When it comes to extending an H-1B, let's say you've had an H-1B for the first 3 years, and now it's time to extend it for another 3 years. The memorandum indicates that you must continue. You must continue to establish that a valid employer relationship exists. So what kind of evidence do they look for on extensions? They want to see that the employee has been paid by the petitioning company, pay records, payroll summaries, W-2 forms, timesheets, prior year's work schedules, documentary examples of the work product created or produced, performance reviews, and any other employment history records to prove that the employee has actually been working for the petitioning employer and supervised and controlled by the petitioning employer. I mentioned, and I want to mention it again because this is somewhat new. The regulations require that where an employee is going to be placed at more than one work location during the term of the contract, a complete itinerary of services and engagements must be attached to the petition, again, with the names and addresses of actual employers and names and addresses of the establishment, venues, locations where the services will be performed in the periods of time. You must have concrete plans in place for the particular employee. And you have to be able to prove that your employee is not being benched without pay between assignments. So that in summary is the memorandum. It's a little more complicated than what I've summarized, but it's a 19-page memorandum, very complex. But how do we now deal with the memorandum? What do we do? Well, petitioning employers, especially staffing companies and consulting companies, who this is really aimed at, they need to modify their relationship with their end clients, if they can. You may find that your end clients are not real flexible. They want control over that employee. They want to direct his work. After all, he's working at their job site and on their product. So it may not be possible to modify your relationship with your end user clients to show that you and not your end user clients control the work of your employee. Now, moving on to the final topic, comprehensive immigration reform. You've probably heard a lot about it in the past. In the past several years, right now there is a proposed law in the House of Representatives. It's been introduced. Whether it will see the light of day or not is another question. But there are other issues that are preventing immigration reform from coming out and being debated as a primary issue at the moment. The economy is being handled by Congress at the moment. Healthcare reform may not be still alive, but it's still being talked about. Global warming, although in Washington, D.C., try to tell them in Washington, D.C., under 4 feet of snow that there's global warming at the moment. But if you were listening to President Obama's State of the Union speech, there was merely one sentence, 38 words, one sentence on immigration reform towards the end of the speech. For a president who ran for office, one of his platform items was immigration reform. it seems like it's been placed on the back burner after his first year in office. We'll see. It's all politics. It's an election year again, which does not bode well for immigration reform. Traditionally, in election years, which are every 2 years, the issue is too controversial for politicians to touch, and therefore they never act on it in election years. So we'll see what happens. But for what it's worth, the proposed immigration law, comprehensive reform law, will increase quotas for foreign nationals coming to work in the United States. It will recapture unused quotas from previous years, which has never been done. Well, it's been done with exception. Most importantly, for the healthcare industry, it would exempt the Schedule A workers. Those are nurses, registered nurses, and physical therapists from the quotas. It would exempt certain other highly educated persons from the quotas, and it would increase the per country limits in cases, so that the two countries most affected by that, China and India, would be on a more more favorable basis under the quotas. But I just leave you with this comment that I tell everybody: it's all politics, and you never know. It just depends on which way the wind is blowing on any given day in Washington, D.C., as to how politics will go and how things will turn out. With that, I'll turn it back over to Leslie for comments and questions and answers. Leslie?
Great. Thank you so much, Tom. Very informative, excellent information. We're going to now use the remainder of our time for Q&A. You've got about 20 minutes or more. I know a lot of you have questions. I would ask that you unmute your phone. We are in presentation mode, so unmute your phone by pressing star 6 to ask a question. And we're all yours now, so we're going to just open up now for Q&A. Would anyone like to ask a question? Remember, unmute your phone by pressing star 6.
Hello?
Yes. Please go ahead.
Yes, I am currently, I'm a staffing industry job shop. I'm currently working with two healthcare professionals that are holding an H-1B, and we are looking at a transfer of this H-1B. From what I can tell in the conversations and the new laws that are in effect, these therapists, per se, or healthcare providers, are exempt from the new laws, correct?
No, they would not be exempt from the employer-employee relationship that I was that I was focusing on. Only exemption that might apply is because they already have H-1Bs, they're exempt from any annual quota. But they are not exempt from the employer-employee relationship that is required. So if it depends on who the H-1B petitioner is in your case. If it is your staffing company and not the end-user healthcare facility, then you must be able to prove that your staffing company is the employer and supervises and controls that employee, and that the end user client does not.
Okay, so in my situation, it is the end user client. So at this point, this would not affect this relationship and or per se this process of consideration from the end user client.
Well, I can see you having difficulty if the end user client is the entity that supervises and controls your healthcare professional, and that you don't, and if you are the petitioning employer on the H-1B petition. Am I correct? You're the petitioning employer?
No. The end user would be the petitioning.
Great.
Oh, okay. All right. All right, so you supply the employee, and then you step out of the picture. Is that correct?
Correct.
Oh. All right. Then in that case, if the end user client is the petitioning employer, and they supervise and control the employee, then I don't see a problem in that case.
Okay. And a little off that subject somewhat, in regards to permanency requests? Are there any new laws or regulations that are in effect that are going to affect green card petitions that you are?
As I finished off the presentation with, comprehensive immigration reform is the proposed law in the House of Representatives, if it ever sees the light of day, as I said, would increase the quotas, hopefully, and speed up the process in getting green cards, especially for healthcare professionals on Schedule A, which at the moment are registered nurses and physical therapists, PTs.
I'm not talking about as a physical therapist.
So I'm sorry?
I said I am discussing a physical therapist. That's what I
Right, heard. Right. Yeah, and if that legislation goes through as it's presently written, and keep in mind most laws are amended many, many, many times in debate in Congress, and if it even gets to the president for signature. But health care, in my opinion, is a priority item. With this health care reform bill that's going to increase health care for everybody in the United States, I don't know where they're going to find the health care employees to do it all. So if health care reform passes, maybe immigration reform, at least in the health care industry, may improve. We'll see.
Very good, very good. And this information, that's part of the media kit, I would assume. Some of the information
yes,
we've discussed. Okay, so we would have information that we would want to review. Very good. All right, I do believe that is my question short of, are you affiliated with the firm, or are you just a guest speaker or presenter with this? What's your status with Leslie and her firm?
I'm affiliated with the firm.
You are affiliated. Okay.
Yes,
so
sir.
If we had further use or questions, we could route this through Leslie, you know, if we were working on an immigration ourselves and be able to, you know, access your expertise per se.
Absolutely, and please do.
Okay, very good.
Yes, we welcome that. Thank you.
Very good. Thank you.
Are there other questions? Press star 6, and then we'll be able to hear you.
Hi, I'm calling from New Jersey.
Hello.
I have a question.
Go ahead.
Regarding, I'm an IT consultant here.
Yes.
Am I audible?
Okay. I can hear you. Please go ahead.
Okay. I'm an IT consultant here in New Jersey area, and one of the comments you made earlier in the discussion was documenting the relationship between the petitioning company and the end client. What happens in a scenario where there are multiple, as you can see, there are multiple layers or multiple consulting companies who have outsourced the work onto the end client? I mean, how does one go about proving the relationship with the actual end client or with the immediate next consulting company in the layer?
Okay, that's a very good question, and recently I have read that the immigration service centers, and this came out of the Vermont service center, by the way, but hopefully it will also come out of the California service center. What they said was, we want to see a letter or the contract itself with the end user client. But we want to see a letter, mainly, from the end-user client that says who supervises and controls the employee that is being placed at that end-user client site. And for an H-1B to work, that letter needs to say that the petitioning employer, the H-1B petitioner, listed on the H-1B petition, is the employer and supervises and controls the work of that employee, and that the end user client does not supervise and control the work of that employee. They don't care about all the vendors in between, all the layers in between. That's what they said in their latest information.
Okay. All right. That's helpful. Thank you. Okay.
Hello, can you hear me?
Yes, I can. Go ahead.
Yes, hi. I am with a life science company. I'm in the Bay Area in California. We do have quite a bit of people on H visas, but particularly we have salespeople that are, you know, non-U.S. citizens that do come in the U.S. and visit customers and clients. Now, given the recent developments, would you say that these people would be subject to these scrutinies if they are on H-1?
They are your employees?
Yes.
Okay, and you supervise and control them, and they work at your office site?
They do work at our office sites abroad, such as maybe Canada or Pac Rim, but when they come to the U.S., they do not only visit our entities in the U.S., but they do go to client sites as well, whether, you know, maybe fixing machines or just selling contracts or things of some sort.
Are they on their own individual H-1Bs?
No, they are sponsored by the company, either H or L.
They're petitioned for by a U.S. company, and they're coming from, they're employed outside the United States, is what you're saying?
Correct.
All right. And they have an H-1B or typically an L visa, or maybe coming on a temporary business visitor visa, B-1. Is that right?
Correct.
All right. Generally, those people, an L-1, depending on if you can get it, under specialized knowledge would work. A B-1, if you structure it properly, and I need to know more facts, of course, but, you know, as long as they're not doing productive employment in the United States, if they're merely meeting with clients and then taking the information back home to implement back at their employer abroad, that's the purpose of a B-1 temporary business visitor visa. You don't need an H-1B for that.
Yeah. Okay.
All right. Thank you.
Thanks.
Hello, Tom.
Hello.
Yeah. I have a quick question with regards to the new ruling on the H-1B. Is that going to be transferred over to the Australian E2 visa as well? Is that going to, are they going to have the same prerequisites?
No.
That's an excellent question. And basically the E3 visa is the same exact criteria and requirements as an H-1B, but it's limited to citizens of Australia. It's called an E3, and it has its own separate quota. But the underlying rule and criteria for E3s is it follows exactly what the H-1B requirements are. So I would tend to think that if the issue comes up on an H-1B, like we've just discussed, it will come up on an E3. Now, keep in mind, E3s, generally you go into the American Embassy or American Consulate in Australia and apply for an E3 based on a personal interview. As a practical matter, is the U.S. Consul in Australia going to be this up to date on the requirements of an H-1B, that these new requirements of H-1Bs that carry over in theory to E-3s? I doubt it, at least for a while. But in theory, yes, you are correct. The criteria are supposed to match. If it applies to an H-1B, then it applies to an E-3. Okay?
Thank you very much.
Hello, this is Tina. I have a couple questions.
Yes, please go ahead.
Okay. My first one will be, I'm the petitioner, and I petitioned a H-1B alien, let's say for argument's sake, a physical therapist, and for a length of 3 years employment.
Okay.
But in the midstream, maybe we have some problem with the end user, and we need to transfer this alien to another site. What happens then?
All right. Who's the employer in this case? That's the key issue that we've been talking about.
The employer will be a staffing company.
The employer will be your staffing company.
Yes.
The employee will be supervised and controlled on the day-to-day work by the staffing company, correct?
Mm-hmm. Correct.
Okay, good. Then in that case, the staffing company would need to, if they're changing locations of the job site, they would need to file an amended H-1B petition and a new LCA with Department of Labor.
So, but but what about the whole relationship aspect of it based on the new regulation?
Well, based on this memorandum that we just discussed, you would again have to show that your end user client, the client site, does not supervise and control the employee, the physical therapist, but you, the staffing company, do supervise and control the day-to-day employment of the
I had thought that if you change your location, all you need is to change, just file a new LCA without going through another petition. Is that, am I correct or am I wrong?
If you change location, you need a new LCA, and if you need a new LCA, you need a new petition, or an amended petition if you're the same employer.
Okay.
Now, Tina, this is Leslie. Uh-huh. If the employee is moving around the block, is basically in the same zip code as the previous employee,
mm-hmm.
You're probably okay in terms of an LCA. But
I do have a nurse that we petitioned and got her here. The original LCA was, I think it was in Georgia, but by the time she arrived, or actually right before she left the country, the end user has changed. And what we did was we basically just did a new LCA.
Mm-hmm.
They didn't refile another H-1B.
Has the nurse made it in?
Yeah.
Okay. Tom, what are your comments on that?
So,
a change of location, if it's outside the if it's a change of location of work, if it's outside the geographical area of the original LCA. Requires a new LCA, and if you need a new LCA, you need an amended H-1B petition. I would suggest that you get an amended H-1B petition. That's a material change to the original H-1B petition. You need to notify the government by an amended petition of the change.
Okay.
We're presuming, Tina, that on the I-129 petition, you differentiated between your address as the employer and the job site address, correct?
Correct.
Okay, well then
on the I-129, no, we left it blank.
You left it blank?
Yes.
Did you have any kind of itinerary or any kind
No,
of...
nothing.
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 Okay.
In that case, you absolutely need to do a new LCA and an amended petition.
Okay. All right.
In the climate that we're in today, Tina, that they're going to permit you to leave that space open anymore.
Right, correct. Yeah, I know that.
Yeah.
Okay. My second question is, if my petition, my original petition was for a nonprofit, and then at the end of the 3-year tenured, can we, we'll ask for an extension, and then can we place that candidate to a for-profit facility, or do we need a brand new one?
No, let's back up a minute. You told me that you were the petitioning employer. Is that correct?
Right.
Your
correct.
Staffing company.
Yes.
Okay. You're a staffing company, and you are the petitioner on the I-129 petition. Correct.
This is the second question. Now has nothing to do with the first one.
I'm asking the same question on this one. In the second question, are you the employer, the staffing company, the employer?
Yes.
All right. and you place somebody at a nonprofit.
Yes.
All right. Then that you already got a number under the quota, so they would be exempt from the quota the next time around.
But next time around, I want to place them into a for-profit facility. Can I do that? Can I use the same petition?
Well, no. You're going to have to file a new petition, but you will not be. That's the bad news. The good news is you would not be subject to the quota.
Ah. So I won't be subject to the quota. Okay. So I don't
because
have to
you,
file.
Because you as the employer, the staffing company as the employer, your employee was counted against the quota the first time around. So you only have to be counted once. So you're not counted against the quota again. So the good news is you can do that new H-1B petition with you as the employer any time of the year, whether the quota is open or not, because you're not subject to the quota the second time around. The bad news is you still have to do the paperwork with an amended petition for a change of location.
Even though the facility, the second facility, second employment, let's say, it's a for-profit facility?
That's irrelevant.
Irrelevant. Okay.
All right.
Okay.
Thank you.
Good.
Thank you.
We've got time for a couple more questions.
Hi, I'm calling from the...
I'll let someone else go first.
Hey.
Hello, go ahead.
Hi, I'm calling from the Boston area, and I work with an IT consulting company here, and I am based in a third-party location. What documentation specifically would you recommend if I would have to travel abroad and to re-enter the country? I understand you already mentioned that a letter from the end client stating that the petitioner has full control over my employment, hiring, firing, is a pretty good proof. Other than that, is there any other documentation, as in, supervision related, that like telephonic conversations, obviously, or meetings? It's hard to document, but is there anything else, like emails or something that you would recommend that we carry along?
Yes. What you should carry with you, obviously you have your passport with your H-1B visa in it, correct?
Right. Correct.
All right. You're going to carry your original H-1B approval notice?
Right.
Right, which will have the name of your consulting company on it, I assume?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. You want to carry your last two or three paycheck stubs from the consulting company who pays your salary?
Yeah.
All right. You want to carry a letter from the consulting company who's the petitioner on your case that verifies that you are currently employed on an ongoing basis by them, what your job title, job duties, and salary are, and that they have complete supervision and control over your employment, job duties, and day-to-day activities?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And
go ahead.
And finally, you may wish to carry a letter from the end user client that your company has a contract with that states that even though you are placed at that job site, your employer in its own letter can say he's placed at a job site, but we have supervision and control. That's what I would carry, and that should do the job.
Yes.
So the a letter from the petitioner stating that he has full control would be sufficient. You don't think there is a necessity for a letter from the end client? Also,
I don't think a letter from the end client would be necessary. In that case, traveling into the United States, I think that I think that that would rather muddy the water if you were to produce that. If you might want to get one from the end client, but keep it in your briefcase and only produce it if the issue comes up.
And you know, I also think that it's very important that the staffing company, your employer, list in the letter the name of the supervisor that you actually report into.
Okay.
I think that, you know, as many dots as you can connect there, the better it will be for you.
And finally, inform your employer, the staffing company or the consulting company, that they may get a phone call. This has been known to happen from Newark Airport. They may get a phone call from a CBP officer at Newark Airport just to confirm that you really work for them and not for somebody else. Okay?
Because they are picking these days. They're actually picking the phone up and calling.
The information we have is this program started at Newark. Now, I've been practicing immigration law for over 30 years, and I've noticed that once these programs get started at one location, they either spread officially to other locations or unofficially to other locations, kind of like a virus. And you may start seeing this at other airports. You cannot be too careful, is my point. Be prepared no matter what airport you're coming through.
And you know, we have also heard if you travel with laptops and electronic devices that, you know, if they feel the need to pull someone into secondary inspection, they will ask your computer and your laptop and your phone.
They've been known to confiscate not permanently. They'll return them. Your hard drive, your cell phone. They search your luggage and confiscate paperwork in there. They've been known to do that in hardcore cases.
And so we just like to equip our clients and our travelers, H-1B travelers and other, you know, they're not just looking into H-1Bs. They're highly scrutinizing Ls. They've knocked on the doors of employers that file O cases in the arts and sciences. I mean, this is sort of not just indicative, this enforcement kind of high scrutiny climate for H-1B travelers. We're
There are
five federal agencies that are knocking on the doors of employers these days.
The scariest part of this whole scenario is the people doing the investigation have no clue what they're looking for or why they're looking for it. So even if everything you have is in total 100% correct order, there's no guarantee it will be understood that way by the investigator, and you may still have a problem. That's my point. You cannot be too prepared or too careful.
And so
because from what I hear, first of all, thanks a lot for that detailed explanation, but from what I hear, the documents that you stated are typically what is recommended, right?
That's right.
Like the letter from the employer and pay stubs and things like that. But I've only heard cases where people have been sent back from the airport to the country that they've been coming from. But do you know specifically what reasons were stated or what were they missing that led the officers to do what they did?
The word that we have is that what's happening at Newark, which is the only place we've been able to pin it down so far, is that the employers who are having these problems with their employees coming through Newark are employers, it seems, that are already under investigation by the government. That's the word
Makes
we
sense.
Have. These are employers. See, the government doesn't have a lot of spare additional resources to spend just going on a fishing expedition looking for something. They generally put their resources where they're going to get some return and some payoff. So these appear to be cases where the employers of these people were already under investigation. And if I were to take a wild guess, and I don't think it's a wild guess, it's an educated guess, I would suspect, based on what we've been talking about, that the employers were staffing companies and or consulting companies. Okay?
Yeah.
Great, thank you.
Okay.
Thomas, one final question for me.
Sure.
You know, you talked about other visas there. from a staffing point of view, I'm obviously the third party and trying to convince immigration that obviously they're the actual employers. Can you actually see that filtering into the trade NAFTA visa, the TN visa as well, eventually, or...?
That's an excellent question too. Yes, I can.
Right. Okay.
But now that being said, I'll say what I said about the E3 visas from Australia. TN NAFTA. You have two ways to do it. You can do the paperwork through the Immigration Service Center, where the mm-hmm. Service Center employees will presumably, and I say that loosely, be more trained and will have read or at least seen this memorandum that we talked about. Or alternatively, you can just go to Canada and make an entry at the port of entry with your documentation as a TN, and then you're at the mercy of a port of entry officer who is a guy with a badge and a gun whose main job is to keep terrorists and criminals out of the United States, and certainly has not been trained with the sophistication level that is needed to understand these legal issues. So,
okay.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you.
This is Tina again. May I indulge you with another question?
Yes,
sure, please.
This will be our last question, Tina.
Oh.
Thank you.
Much earlier, someone had mentioned that even Canadian H-1B is being questioned in a tougher way.
Yep.
Are we talking about TN or H-1B?
No, we were talking about I'm talking about H-1Bs in general, and along the Canadian border, we always hear stories about those particular port of entry officers doing strange things.
Yeah.
Or arbitrary things. But what I was just, the last question, the caller before you specifically asked about TN, and he asked if the concepts that we've been discussing, the issues we've been discussing today, would
right.
carry over and possibly affect the TNs. And in
right.
my opinion, eventually, with proper training, and even with lack of training, they may do so also, and that's a scary thing. I could see those people who already have a lack of training, and it's not their fault. I mean, the government has limited resources, but it's just a fact of life we have to deal with. And I can see it carrying through all phases: H-1Bs, TNs, E-3s from Australia. Sure.
Because I'm just about to have a Canadian alien come over on the TN.
Well, what we did hear, Tina, was CBP officers getting very hard-nosed with Canadians at the border applying for H-1B entries,
mm-hmm.
where they decided to express their opinions regarding, you know, why are U.S. employers hiring Canadians when the unemployment rate is so high in the United States? And they started sort of spreading their opinions around and disarming the applicants completely. So, you know, there are just skirmishes like this happening, and we're hearing, you know, incidents trickle down. But I have not myself, and I don't think Tom has, heard anything hard-nosed and over-scrutinized about TNs, other than that you just have to kind of over-document, make sure that you've got a complete employer letter, make sure that all of the right supporting documentation is there, educational credentials, that they're coming in strictly for temporary work purposes, and you should have, you know, hopefully no problem.
Does H-1B applicable to Canadians? I thought...
Oh,
no.
Yeah.
Oh, absolutely. Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
Okay.
Yeah. I mean, there are, you know, there are applicants all over the world that enter the United States in H-1B classification if the background is, you know, makes them eligible for that classification.
Well, why would a citizen...
Just because Canadians and Mexican citizens, for that matter, can get TNs, that doesn't preclude them from getting H-1Bs in the alternative.
Or O-1 visas or Ls or any other employment-related classification. It's open to them and every other country in the world.
What is the difference between, isn't a TN much easier route to come in?
Well, it's easy and quick.
NAFTA was designed to make less paperwork and less bureaucratic red tape for Canadians and later Mexican citizens to come in positions that oftentimes are very similar or the same as H-1Bs. But why would a Canadian or Mexican citizen get an H-1B when they can easily get a TN? Well, the reason is very simple. TN is a non-immigrant intent visa. Strictly non-immigrant intent. Once you start the green card process, you're not going to get an extension or be able to travel on your TN. So you want to get into H-1B status before you start a green card, because in H-1B, H-1B is a dual intent visa, and H-1B is not affected by your starting the green card process.
Ah, okay. So we're talking about people who are ultimately want the green card.
Yes.
Generally, yes. That's the reason why someone from a TN country would get an H-1B instead of a TN. Yeah.
Okay. Thank you.
Good. Tina.
Yeah.
I'll add one other comment. The other reason would be if there's some doubt whether the occupation they're in is on or not on the TN list. You know, in that case, they may be able to get an H-1B and not be able to get a TN.
Right. Okay, thank you so much.
You're welcome. Thank you. This has been a great Q&A session. We encourage you, if you haven't had a chance to ask your question today or you're mulling it over and a question occurs to you, you can certainly reach out through phone and email. We're here. We also understand that much of the information that we presented today may change the landscape considerably for your ability to move forward in filing for H-1B workers, and we're here for consultation and here to assist you with your filings as well. We're certainly in the process of doing casework, H-1B casework right now. So thank you so much. Please sign up to receive our information. We will do several telephone conferences. We're going to shoot for at least one conference a month. So thank you so much. Thank you for your valuable time. Have a great day.
Thank you so much.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye.